dotted with farms, mills, and grand stone estates that reminded him of the ones near Aros. Some 5 miles away, the plane arrived at the outer walls of Urubane. Unlike those of Drusliona, the walls of the capital were long enough to encompass the whole of the city. They were taller, too, even from a distance. Roram could see that they dwarfed those of both Drusliona and Aros. He guessed that they stood at least 300 feet tall. Upon the wide battlements, he spotted ballistae and catapults mounted at regular intervals. The sight worried him. The machines would be difficult to take down. No doubt they were protected from magical attacks, and he knew from experience just how deadly such weapons could be. Behind the walls was an odd mixture of human-built structures, and those he guessed the elves had made. The most prominent of the elven buildings were 6 tall, graceful towers, made of a malachite green stone, which were scattered in an arc throughout what he assumed was the oldest part of the city. 2 of the towers were missing their roofs, and he thought he saw the stumps of 2 more, partially buried among the jumble of houses below. What interested him most, however, was not the wall or the buildings, but the fact that much of the city lay shadowed underneath a huge stone shelf, which must have been over 0.5 mile wide and 500 feet thick at its narrowest. The overhang formed one end of a massive sloping hill that stretched off to the northeast for several miles. Atop the craggy lip of the shelf stood another wall, like that which surrounded the city, and several thick watchtowers. At the back of the cave-like recess underneath the shelf was an enormous citadel adorned with a profusion of towers and parapets. The citadel rose high above the rest of the city, high enough that it almost scraped the underside of the shelf. Most intimidating of all was the gate set within the front of the fortress, a great gaping cavern that looked large enough for Saphira and Thorn to walk through side by side. Roran's gut tightened. If the gate was any indication, Shrukan was big enough to wipe out their whole army by himself. Aragorn and Saphira had better hurry up, he thought, and the elves too. From what he had seen, the elves might be able to hold their own against the king's black dragon, but even they would be hard-pressed to kill him. All that and more, Roran took in as he paused on the ridge. Then he tugged on Snowfire's reins. Behind him, the white stallion snorted and followed as Roran resumed his weary march, following the winding road as it descended to the lowlands. He could have ridden, was supposed to ride, actually, as captain of his battalion. But after his trip to Aros and back, he had come to loathe sitting in a saddle. As he walked, he tried to figure out how best to attack the city. The pocket of stone Urubane sat nestled within would prevent assaults from the side and the rear, and would interfere with attacks from above, which was surely why the elves had chosen to settle in that location to begin with. If we could somehow break off the overhang, we could crush the citadel and most of the city, he thought. But he deemed that unlikely, as the stone was too thick. Still, we might be able to take the wall at the top of the hill. Then we could drop stones and pour boiling oil onto those below. It wouldn't be easy, though. Uphill fighting and those walls. Maybe the elves could manage it. Or the Cull. They might enjoy it. The Rama River was several miles north of Urubane, too far to be of any help. Saphira could dig a ditch large enough to divert it, but even she would need weeks to complete such a project, and the Varden did not have weeks' worth of food. They had only a few days left. After that, they would have to starve or disband. Their only option was to attack before the Empire did. Not that Roran believed Galbatorix would attack. So far, the king had seemed content to allow the Varden to come to him. Why should he risk his neck? The longer he waits, the weaker we grow. Which meant a frontal assault. A brazen fool's charge over open ground, toward walls too thick to breach and too tall to climb, while archers and war machines shot at them the whole time. Just imagining it made a sweat break out on his brow. They would die in droves, he cursed. We'll dash ourselves to pieces and all the while Galbatorix will sit laughing in his throne room. If we can get close to the walls, the soldiers won't be able to hit us with their foul contraptions, but then we'll be vulnerable to pitch and oil and rocks being dropped on our heads. Even if they managed to breach the walls, they would still have the whole of Galbatorix's army to overcome. More important than the defences of the city then would be the character and quality of the men the Varden would face. Would they fight to their last breath? Could they be frightened? Would they break and flee if pushed hard enough? What manner of oaths and spells bound them? The Varden spies had reported that Galbatorix had placed an earl by the name of Lord Bast in command of the troops within Urabane. Roran had never heard of Bast before, but the information seemed to dismay Jormungandr, and the men in Roran's battalion had shared enough stories to persuade him of Bast's villainy. Supposedly, Bast had been lord of a rather large estate near Gilead, which the invasion of the elves had forced him to abandon. His vassals had lived in mortal fear of him, for Bast had a tendency to resolve disputes and punish criminals in the harshest manner possible, often choosing to simply execute those he believed were in the wrong. Of itself, that was hardly notable. Many a lord throughout the empire had a reputation for brutality. Bast, however, was not only ruthless, but strong, impressively strong, and cunning to boot. In everything Roran had heard about Bast, the man's intelligence had been clear. Bast might be a bastard, but he was a smart bastard, and Roran knew it would be a mistake to underestimate him. Galbatorix would not have chosen a weakling or a dullard to command his men. And then there were Thorn and Murtagh. Galbatorix might not stir from his stronghold, but the Red Dragon and his rider were sure to defend the city. Aragorn and Saphira will have to lure them away, otherwise we'll never make it over the walls. Roran frowned. That would be a problem. Murtagh was stronger than Aragorn now. Aragorn would need the help of the elves to kill him. Once again, Roran felt bitter anger and resentment welling up inside him. He hated that he was at the mercy of those who could use magic. At least when it came to strength and cunning, a man might make up for a lack of one with a surfeit of the other. But there was no making up for the absence of magic. Frustrated, he scooped up a pebble from the ground, and as Aragorn had taught him, said, "Stena Risa." The pebble remained motionless. The pebble always remained motionless. He snorted and tossed it by the side of the road. His wife and unborn child were with the Varden, and yet there was nothing he could do to kill either Murtagh or Galbatorix. He clenched his fists and imagined breaking things. Bones, mostly. Maybe we should flee. It was the first time the thought had occurred to him. He knew there were lands to the east beyond Galbatorix's reach, fertile plains where none but nomads lived. If the other villagers came with him and Katrina, they could start anew, free of the Empire and Galbatorix. The idea made him sick to consider, however. He would be abandoning Aragorn, his men, and the land he called home. No, I won't allow our child to be born into a world where Galbatorix still holds sway. Better to die than to live in fear. Of course, that still did not solve the problem of how to capture Urabane. Always before, there had been a weakness he could exploit. In Carvajal, it had been the Razak's failure to understand that the villagers would fight. When he wrestled with the Urgal, Yarbog, it had been the creature's horns. In Aros, it had been the canals. But here at Urabane, he saw no weaknesses, no place where he could turn his opponent's strength against them. If we had the supplies, I would wait and starve them out. That would be the best way. Anything else is madness. But as he knew, war was a catalogue of madness. Magic is the only way, he finally concluded. Magic and Saphira. If we can kill Murtagh, then either she or the elves will have to help us pass the walls. He scowled, a sour taste in his mouth, and quickened his stride. The faster they made camp, the better, His feet were sore from walking, and if he was going to die in a senseless charge, then at least he wanted a hot meal and a good night's sleep beforehand. The Vardens set up their tents a mile from Uruvain, by a small stream that fed the Ramur River. Then the men, dwarves and Urgals, began constructing defences, a process that would continue until night, and then resume in the morning. In fact, as long as they stayed in one location, they would continue to work on reinforcing their perimeter. The warriors detested the labour, but it kept them busy, and moreover, it might save their lives. Everyone thought the orders came from the Shadow Aragorn. Rohan knew they actually came from Jormungandr. He had come to respect the older warrior since Nasawada's abduction and Aragorn's departure. Jormungandr had been fighting the Empire nearly his whole life, and he had a deep understanding of tactics and logistics. He and Rohan got along well. They were both men of steel, not magic. And then there was King Orin, with whom, after the initial defences had been established, Rohan found himself arguing. Orin never failed to irritate him. If anyone was going to get them killed, it was him. Rohan knew that offending a king was not the healthiest thing to do. But the fool wanted to send a messenger to the front gates of Uruvain and issue a formal challenge, the way they had at Dras Leona and Bellatona. "Do you want to provoke Galbatorix?" Rohan growled. "If we do that, he might respond." "Well, of course," said King Orin, drawing himself upright. "It's only proper that we announce our intentions and provide him with the opportunity to parley for peace." Rohan stared. Then he turned away in disgust and said to Jormungandr, "Can't you make him see reason?" The three of them were gathered in Orin's pavilion, where the king had summoned them. "Your Majesty," said Jormungandr, "Rohan is right. It would be best to wait to contact the Empire." "But they can see us," protested Orin. "We're camped right outside their walls. It would be rude not to send an envoy to state our position." "You are both commoners. I would not expect you to understand. Royalty demands certain courtesies, even if we are at war." An urge to strike the king swept through Rohan. "Are you so puffed up as to believe Galbatorix considers you an equal? Bah! We're insects to him. He cares nothing for your courtesy. You forget Galbatorix was a commoner like us before he overthrew the Riders. His ways are not your ways. There is no one like him in the world, and you think to predict him? You think to placate him? Bah!" Orin's face coloured, and he threw aside his goblet of wine, dashing it against the rug upon the ground. "You go too far, Stronghammer. No man has the right to insult me like that." "I have the right to do whatever I want," growled Rohan. "I'm not one of your subjects. I don't answer to you. I'm a free man, and I'll insult anyone I choose, whenever I choose, however I choose, even you. It would be a mistake to send that messenger, and I—" There was a screech of sliding steel as King Orin tore his sword from its scabbard. He did not catch Rohan entirely unawares. Rohan already had his hand on his hammer, and as he heard the sound, he yanked the weapon from his belt. The king's blade was a silver blur in the dim light of the tent. Rohan saw where Orin was going to strike and stepped out of the way. Then he wrapped the flat of the king's sword, causing it to flex and ring and leap out of Orin's hand. The jeweled weapon fell onto the rug, the blade quivering. "Sire," cried one of the guards outside, "are you all right?" "I just dropped my shield," replied Jormungandr. "There's no need for concern." "Sir, yes, sir." Rohan stared at the king. There was a wild, hunted look on Orin's face. Without taking his eyes off him, Rohan returned his hammer to his belt. "Contacting Galbatorix is stupid and dangerous. If you try, I'll kill whomever you send before he reaches the city." "You wouldn't dare," said Orin. "I would, and I will. I won't let you endanger the rest of us just to satisfy your royal pride. If Galbatorix wants to talk, then he knows where to find us. Otherwise, let him be." Roran stormed out of the pavilion. Outside, he stood with his hands on his hips and gazed at the puffy clouds while he waited for his pulse to subside. Orin was like a yearling mule, stubborn, overconfident, and all too willing to kick you in the gut if he gave him the opportunity. "And he drinks too much," thought Roran. He paced in front of the pavilion until Jormund emerged. Before the other man could speak, Roran said, "I'm sorry." "As well you should be." Jormund drew a hand over his face, then removed a clay pipe from the purse on his belt and began to fill it with cardus weed, which he tamped down with the ball of his thumb. "It took me this whole time to convince him not to send an envoy, just to spite you." He paused for a moment. "Would you really kill one of Orin's men?"
"I don't make idle threats," said Roran.
"No, I didn't think so."
"Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that."
Jormundur started down the path between the tents, and Roran followed. As they walked, men moved out of their way and respectfully dipped their heads. Gesturing with his unlit pipe, Jormundur said,
"I admit I've wanted to give Orin a good tongue-lashing on more than one occasion."
His lips stretched in a thin smile.
"Unfortunately, discretion has always gotten the better of me."
"Has he always been so intractable?"
"Hmm? No, no. In Sirda he was far more reasonable."
"What happened then?"
"Fear, I think. It does strange things to men."
"Aye.
It may offend you to hear this, but you acted rather stupidly yourself."
"I know. My temper got the better of me."
"And you've earned yourself a king as a foe."
"You mean another king?"
Jormundur uttered a low laugh. "Yes, well, I suppose when you have Galbatorix as a personal enemy, all others seem rather harmless. Nevertheless..."
He stopped by a campfire and pulled a thin, burning branch from the midst of the flames. Tipping the end of the branch into the bowl of his pipe, he puffed several times, setting the flame, then threw the branch back into the fire.
"Nevertheless, I wouldn't ignore Orin's anger. He was willing to kill you back there. If he holds a grudge, and I think he will, he may seek his revenge. I'll post a guard by your tent for the next few days."
"After that, though..." Jormundur shrugged.
"After that, we may all be dead or enslaved."
They walked in silence for a few more minutes, Jormundur puffing on his pipe the whole while. As they were about to part, Roran said,
"When you see Orin next..."
"Yes?"
"Perhaps you could let him know that if he or his men hurt Katrina, I'll rip out his guts in front of the whole camp."
Jormundur tucked his chin against his breast and stood thinking for a moment. Then he looked up and nodded.
"I think I might find a way to do that, Stronghammer."
"My thanks."
"You're most welcome. As always, this was a unique pleasure."
"Sir." Roran sought out Katrina and convinced her to bring their dinner to the northern embankment, where he kept vigil for any messengers Orin might send. They ate on a cloth that Katrina spread over the freshly turned soil, then sat together as the shadows grew long, and the stars began to appear in the purple sky above the overhang.
"I'm glad to be here," she said, leaning her head against his shoulder.
"Are you? Really?
It's beautiful, and I have you all to myself."
She squeezed his arm. He drew her closer, but the shadow in his heart remained. He could not forget the danger that threatened her and their child. The knowledge that their greatest foe was but a few miles distant burned within him. He wanted nothing more than to leap up, run to Urabane, and kill Galbatorix. But that was impossible. So he smiled and laughed and hid his fear, even as he knew she hid hers.
"Blasted Eragon," he thought. "You'd better hurry, or I swear I'll haunt you from the grave."
War Council. On the flight from Vroengard to Urabane, Saphira did not have to battle her way through a storm,
and was fortunate enough to have a tailwind to speed her progress. For the Eldenari told her where to find the fast-moving stream of air, which they said blew nearly every day of the year. Also, the Eldenari fed her a constant supply of energy, so she never flagged or grew tired. As a result, the city first came into sight on the horizon a mere 2 days after they departed the island. Twice during the trip, when the sun was at its brightest, Aragorn thought he glimpsed the entrance to the pocket of space where the Eldunari floated hidden behind Saphira. It appeared as a single dark point, so small that he could not keep his eyes fixed upon it for more than a second. At first he assumed it was a mote of dust, but then he noticed that the point never varied in its distance from Saphira. And when he saw it, it was always in the same place. As they flew, the dragons had, through Umarov, poured memory after memory into Aragorn and Saphira, a cascade of experiences. Battles won and battles lost, loves, hates, spells, events witnessed throughout the land, regrets, realizations, and ponderings concerning the workings of the world. The dragons possessed thousands of years of knowledge, and they seemed driven to share every last bit.
"It's too much," Aragorn had protested. "We can't remember it all, much less understand it."
"No," said Umarov. "But you can remember some, and it may be that some will be what you need to defeat Galbatorix. Now, let us continue."
The torrent of information was overwhelming. At times Aragorn felt as if he was forgetting who he was, for the dragon's memories far outnumbered his own. When that happened, he would separate his mind from theirs and repeat his true name to himself, until he again felt secure in his identity. The things he and Saphira learned amazed and troubled him, and oftentimes caused him to question his own beliefs. But he never had time to dwell on such thoughts, for there was always another memory to take their place. It would, he knew, take him years to begin to make sense of what the dragons were showing them. The more he learned about the dragons, the more he regarded them with awe. Those who had lived for hundreds of years were strange in their ways of thinking, and the oldest were as different from Gleyda and Saphira as Gleyda and Saphira were from the Fanghur in the Beor Mountains. Interacting with these elders was confusing and unsettling. They made jumps, associations, and comparisons that seemed meaningless, but that Aragorn knew made sense at some deep level. He was rarely able to figure out what they were trying to say, and the ancient dragons did not deign to explain themselves in terms that he could understand. After a while, he realized that they couldn't express themselves in any other way. Over the centuries, their minds had changed. What was simple and straightforward for him often seemed complicated for them, and the same was true in reverse. Listening to their thoughts, he felt, must be like listening to the thoughts of a god. When he made that particular observation, Saphira snorted and said to him,
"There is a difference."
"What?"
"Unlike gods, we take part in the events of the world."
"Perhaps the gods choose to act without being seen."
"Then what good are they?"
"You believe that dragons are better than gods?" he asked, amused.
"When we are fully grown, yes. What creature is greater than us? Even Galbatorix depends upon us for his strength."
"What of the Nithwal?" she sniffed.
"We can swim, but they cannot fly."
The very oldest of the Eldunari, a dragon by the name of Valdur, which meant ruler in the ancient language, spoke to them directly only once. From him they received a vision of beams of light turning into waves of sand, as well as a disconcerting sense that everything that seemed solid was mostly empty space. Then Valdur showed them a nest of sleeping starlings, and Aragorn could feel their dreams flickering in their minds, fast as the blink of an eye. At first, Valdur's emotion was one of contempt. The starlings' dreams seemed tiny, petty, and inconsequential. But then his mood changed and became warm and sympathetic, and even the smallest of the starlings' concerns grew in importance until it seemed equal to the worries of kings. Valdur lingered over the vision, as if to make sure that Aragorn and Saphira would remember it, amid all the other memories. Yet neither of them was certain what the dragon was trying to say, and Valda refused to explain himself further. When at last Urabane came into view, the Eldunari ceased sharing their memories with Aragorn and Saphira, and Umaroth said,
"Now you would be best served by studying the lair of our foe."
This they did, as Saphira descended toward the ground over the course of many leagues. What they saw did not encourage either of them, nor did their moods improve when Gleda said,
"Calbatorix has built much since he drove us from this place. The walls were not so thick nor so tall in our day."
To which Umaroth added,
"Nor was Illyria this heavily fortified during the war between our kind and the elves. The traitor has burrowed deep and piled a mountain of stone about his hole. He will not come out of his own accord, I think. He is like a badger who has retreated into his den, and who will bloody the nose of anyone who tries to dig him out."
A mile southwest from the wall shelf and the city beneath lay the Varden's camp. It was significantly larger than Aragorn remembered, which puzzled him until he realized that Queen Islanzadi and her army must have finally joined forces with the Varden. He gave a small sigh of relief. Even Galbatorix was wary of the might of the elves. When he and Saphira were a league or so from the tents, the Eldunari helped Aragorn extend the range of his thoughts until he was able to feel the minds of the men, dwarves, elves, and Urgals gathered within the camp. His touch was too light for anyone to notice, unless they were deliberately watching for it. And the moment he located the distinctive strain of wild music that marked Blodgarm's thoughts, he narrowed his focus to the elf alone.
"Blodgarm," he said, "it is I, Aragorn."
The more formal phrasing seemed natural to him, after so long spent reliving experiences from ages past.
"Shadeslayer, are you safe? Your mind feels most strange. Is Saphira with you? Is she hurt? Has something happened to Gleda?"
"They are both well, as am I."
"Then..."
Blodgarm's confusion was evident. Cutting him off, Aragorn said,
"We're not far, but I've hidden us from sight for the time being. Is the illusion of Saphira and me still visible to those below?"
"Yes, Shadeslayer. We have Saphira circling the tents a mile above. Sometimes we hide her in a bank of clouds, or we make it seem as if you and she have gone off on patrol. But we dare not let Galbatorix think you've left for long. We will make your images fly away now, so that you may rejoin us without arousing suspicion."
"No. Rather wait and maintain your spells for a while longer."
"Shadeslayer?"
"We are not returning directly to the camp."
Aragorn glanced at the ground.
"There's a small hill, perhaps 2 miles to the southeast. Do you know it?"
"Yes, I can see it."
"Saphira will land behind it. Have Arya, Oric, Jormunda, Rohan, Queen Islanzadi, and King Orin join us there. But make sure they do not leave the camp all at once. If you could help hide them, that would be best. You should come as well."
"As you wish. Shadeslayer, what did you find on—"
"No, do not ask me. It would be dangerous to think of it here. Come, and I will tell you. But I do not want to blare the answer where others might be listening."
"I understand. We will meet with you as quickly as we can, but it may take some time to stagger our departures correctly."
"Of course. I trust you'll do what's best."
Aragorn severed their connection and leaned back in the saddle. He smiled slightly as he imagined Blodgarm's expression when he learned of the Eldunari. With a whirl of wind, Saphira landed in the hollow by the base of the hill, startling a flock of nearby sheep who scurried away while uttering plaintive bleats. As she folded her wings, Saphira looked after the sheep and said,
"It would be easy to catch them, since they cannot see me."
She licked her chops. "Yes, but where would be the sport in that?" Aragorn asked, loosening the straps around his legs.
"Sport does not fill your belly."
"No, but then you aren't hungry, are you?" The energy from the Eldunari, though insubstantial, had suppressed her desire to eat. She released a great amount of air in what seemed to be a sigh.
"No, not really."
While they waited, Aragorn stretched his sore limbs, then ate a light lunch from what remained of his provisions. He knew that Saphira was sprawled her full, sinuous length on the ground next to him, though he could not see her. Her presence was betrayed only by the shadowed impression her body left upon the flattened stalks of grass, like a strangely shaped hollow. He was not sure why, but the sight amused him. As he ate, he gazed out at the pleasant fields around the hill, watching the stir of air in the stalks of wheat and barley. Long, low walls of piled stone separated the fields. It must have taken the local farmers hundreds of years to dig so many stones out of the ground. At least that wasn't a problem we had in Palancar Valley, he thought. A moment later, one of the dragon's memories returned to him, and he knew exactly how old the stone walls were. They dated to the time when humans had come to live in the ruins of Illyria, after the elves had defeated King Palancar's warriors. He could see, as if he had been there, lines of men, women, and children, combing over freshly tilled fields and carrying the rocks they found over to where the walls would be. After a time, Aragorn allowed the memory to fade away, and then he opened his mind to the ebb and flow of energy around them. He listened to the thoughts of the mice in the grass, and the worms in the earth, and the birds that fluttered past overhead. It was a slightly risky thing to do, for he could end up alerting any nearby enemy spellcasters to their presence. But he preferred to know who and what was close, so that no one could attack them by surprise. Thus he sensed the approach of Arya, Blodgarm, and Queen Islanzadi, and he was not alarmed when the shadows of their footsteps moved toward him from around the western side of the hill. The air rippled like water, and then the three elves appeared before him. Queen Islanzadi stood in the lead, as regal as ever. She was garbed in a golden corselet of scale armor, with a jeweled helm upon her head, and her red, white-trimmed cape clasped about her shoulders. A long, slim sword hung from her narrow waist. She carried a tall, white-bladed spear in one hand, and a shield shaped like a birch leaf, its edges were even serrated like a leaf, in the other. Arya, too, was clad in fine armor. She had exchanged her usual dark clothes for a corselet like her mother's, although Arya's was the grey of bare steel, not gold, and she wore a helm decorated with embossed knotwork upon the brow and nosepiece, and a pair of stylized eagle wings that swept back from her temples. Compared with the splendor of Islanzadi's raiment, Arya's was somber, but all the more deadly because of it. Together, mother and daughter were like a pair of matched blades, where one was adorned for display and one fitted for combat. Like the two women, Blodgarm wore a shirt of scale armor, but his head was bare, and he carried no weapon besides a small knife on his belt. "Show yourself, Aragorn Shadeslayer," said Islanzadi, looking toward the spot where he stood. Aragorn released the spell that concealed him and Saphira, then bowed to the Elf Queen. She ran her dark eyes over him, studying him as if he were a prized draft horse. Unlike before, he had no difficulty holding her gaze. After a few seconds, the Queen said, "You have improved, Shadeslayer." He gave a second, shorter bow. "Thank you, Your Majesty." As always, the sound of her voice sent a thrill through him. It seemed to hum with magic and music, as if every word were part of an epic poem. "Such a compliment means much from one so wise and fair as you." Islanzadi laughed, showing her long teeth, and the hill and the fields rang with her mirth. "And you have grown eloquent as well. You did not tell me he had become so well-spoken, Arya." A faint smile touched Arya's face.
He is still learning.
Then to Aragorn she said,
It is good to see you safely returned.
The elves plied him, Saphira, and Bleda with numerous questions, but the three of them refused to provide answers until the others had arrived. Still, Aragorn thought that the elves sensed something of the Eldunari, for he noticed that they sometimes glanced in the direction of the Heart of Hearts, although they seemed not to realize it. Oric was the next to join them. He rode from the south on a shaggy pony that was lathered and panting.
"Ho, Aragorn! Ho, Saphira!"
the dwarf king cried, raising a fist. He slid down from his exhausted mount, stomped over, and pulled Aragorn into a rough embrace, pounding him on the back. When they had finished greeting each other, and Oric had given Saphira a rub on her nose, which made her hum, Aragorn asked, "Where are your guards?" Oric gestured over his shoulder.
"Braiding their beards by a farmhouse a mile west of here, and none too happy about it, I dare say. I trust every last one of them, their clanmates of mine. But Blodgarm said I should best come alone, so alone I've come. Now tell me, why this secrecy? What did you discover on Vroengard?"
"You'll have to wait for the rest of our council to find out," said Aragorn. "But I am glad to see you again." And he clapped Oric on the shoulder. Roran arrived on foot soon afterward, looking grim and dusty. He gripped Aragorn's arm and welcomed him, then pulled him aside and said, "Can you stop them from hearing us?" He motioned with his chin toward Oric and the elves. It took Aragorn only a few seconds to cast a spell that shielded them from listeners. "Done." At the same time, he separated his mind from Gleda and the other Eldunari, although not from Saphira. Roran nodded and looked off over the fields. "I had some words with King Orin while you were gone."
"Words? How so?"
"He was being a fool and I told him so."
"I take it he didn't react very kindly."
"You could say that.
He tried to stab me."
"He what?"
"I managed to knock his sword out of his hand before he could land a blow, but if he had had his way, he would have killed me."
"Orin?" Aragorn had trouble imagining the king doing any such thing.
"Did you hurt him badly?"
For the first time, Roran smiled, a brief expression that quickly vanished under his beard.
"I scared him, which might be worse."
Aragorn grunted and clenched the pommel of Brisinger. He realized that he and Roran were mirroring each other's posture. They both had their hands on their weapons, and they both stood with their weight on the opposite leg.
"Who else knows of this?"
"Jormungandr, he was there, and whomever Orin has told." Frowning, Aragorn began to pace back and forth as he tried to decide what to do.
"The timing of this couldn't be worse."
"I know.
I wouldn't have been so blunt with Orin, but he was about to send royal greetings to Galbatorix and other such nonsense. He would have put us all in danger. I couldn't allow that to happen."
"You would have done the same."
"Maybe so. But this just makes things all the more difficult. I'm the leader of the Varden now. An attack on you or any of the other warriors under my command is the same as an attack on me. Orin knows that, and he knows we're of the same blood. He might as well have thrown a gauntlet in my face."
"He was drunk," said Roran. "I'm not sure he was thinking of that when he drew his sword." Aragorn saw Arya and Blodgarm giving him curious glances. He stopped pacing and turned his back to them.
"I'm worried about Katrina," Roran added. "If Orin is angry enough, he might send his men after me or her. Either way, she could get hurt. Jormungandr has already posted a guard at our tent, but that's not enough protection."
Aragorn shook his head.
"Orin wouldn't dare hurt her."
"No,
he can't harm you, and he doesn't have the stomach to confront me directly. So what does that leave? An ambush, knives in the dark. Killing Katrina would be an easy way for Orin to have his revenge."
"I doubt that Orin would resort to knives in the dark, or harming Katrina."
"You can't say for sure, though."
Aragorn thought for a moment. "I'll place some spells on Katrina to keep her safe, and I'll let Orin know that I've placed them. That should put a stop to any plans he might have." The tension in Roran seemed to drain away. I'd appreciate that. I'll give you some new wards as well.
No, save your strength. I can take care of myself.
Aragorn insisted, but Roran kept refusing. Finally, Aragorn said,
Blast it, listen to me. We're about to go into battle against Galbatorix's men. You have to have some protection, if only against magic.
I'm going to give you wards whether you like it or not, so you might as well smile and thank me for them.
Roran glowered at him, then he grunted and raised his hands.
Fine. As you wish. You never did know when it was sensible to give up.
Oh, and you do?
A chuckle came from within the depths of Roran's beard.
I suppose not. I guess it runs in the family.
Between Brom and Garrow, I don't know who was the more stubborn.
Father was, said Roran.
Brom was as... No, you're right. It was Garrow. They exchanged grins, remembering their life on the farm.
Then Roran shifted his stance and gave Aragorn an odd, sideways look.
You seem different than before.
Do I?
Yes, you do.
You seem more sure of yourself.
Perhaps it's because I understand myself better than I once did.
To that, Roran had no answer.
Half an hour later, Jormungandr and King Orin rode up together. Aragorn greeted Orin as politely as ever, but Orin responded with a curt reply and avoided his gaze. Even from a distance of several feet, Aragorn could smell wine on his breath. Once they were all assembled before Saphira, Aragorn began. First he had everyone swear oaths of secrecy in the ancient language. Then he explained the concept of an Eldunari to Oric, Roran, Jormungandr, and Orin, and he recounted a brief history of the dragon's gem-like hearts with the riders in Galbatorix. The elves appeared uneasy with Aragorn's willingness to discuss the Eldunari before the others, but none protested, which pleased him. He had earned that much trust, at least. Oric, Roran, and Jormungandr reacted with surprise, disbelief, and dozens of questions. Roran, in particular, acquired a sharp gleam in his eye, as if the information had given him a host of new ideas on how to kill Galbatorix. Throughout, Orin was surly, and remained stridently unconvinced of the existence of the Eldunari. In the end, the only thing that quelled his doubts was when Aragorn removed Glaider's Heart of Hearts from the saddlebags and introduced the dragon to the four of them. The awe they displayed at meeting Glaider gratified Aragorn. Even Orin seemed impressed, although after exchanging a few words with Glaider, he turned on Aragorn and said,
Did Nasawada know of this?
Yes, I told her at Feinster.
As Aragorn expected, the admission displeased Orin.
So once again, the two of you chose to ignore me. Without the support of my men and the food of my nation, the Varden would have had no hope of confronting the Empire. I am the sovereign ruler of one of only four countries in Alagasia. My army makes up a goodly portion of our forces, and yet neither of you deemed it appropriate to inform me of this.
Before Aragorn could respond, Oric stepped forward.
They did not tell me about it either, Orin,
the dwarf king rumbled.
And mine people have helped the Varden for longer than yours. You should not take offense. Aragorn and Nasawada did what they thought was best for our cause. They meant no disrespect.
Orin scowled and looked as if he was going to continue arguing. But Glaider preempted him by saying,
They did as I asked. King of the Sodans. The Eldunari are the greatest secret of our race, and we do not share it lightly with others, even kings.
Then why have you chosen to do so now? Demanded Orin. You could have gone into battle without ever revealing yourself.
In answer, Aragorn recounted the story of their trip to Vroengard, including their encounter with the storm at sea, and the sight they had witnessed at the very top of the clouds. Arya and Blodgarm seemed the most interested in that part of his story, whereas Oric was the most uncomfortable.
Bazul, but that sounds a nasty experience, he said. It makes me shiver just to think of it. The ground is the proper place for a dwarf, not the sky.
I agree, said Saphira,
which caused Oryk to scowl suspiciously and twist the braided ends of his beard. Resuming his tale, Aragorn told of how he, Saphira, and Gleda had entered the Vault of Souls, though he refrained from divulging that this had required their true names. And when he at last revealed what the vault had contained, there was a moment of shocked silence. Then Aragorn said, "Open your minds." A moment later, the sound of whispering voices seemed to fill the air, and Aragorn felt the presence of Umaroth and the other hidden dragons surround them. The elves staggered, and Arya dropped to one knee, pressing a hand to the side of her head as if she had been struck. Oryk uttered a cry and looked about wild-eyed, while Roran, Jormunda, and Orin stood dumbfounded. Queen Islanzadi knelt, adopting a pose much like her daughter's. In his mind, Aragorn heard her speaking to the dragons, greeting many by name, and welcoming them as old friends. Blodgarm did likewise, and for several minutes a flurry of thoughts passed between the dragons and those gathered at the base of the hill. The mental cacophony was so great, Aragorn shielded himself from it, and retreated to sit on one of Saphira's forelegs, while he waited for the noise to subside. The elves seemed most affected by the revelation. Blodgarm stared into the air with an expression of joy and wonder, while Arya continued to kneel. Aragorn thought he saw a line of tears on each of her cheeks. Islanzadi beamed with a triumphant radiance, and for the first time since he had met her, Aragorn thought she seemed truly happy. Oryk shook himself then and broke from his reverie. Looking over at Aragorn, he said,
"By Morgothal's hammer, this puts a new twist on things. With their help, we might actually be able to kill Galbatorix."
"You didn't think we could before?" Aragorn asked mildly.
"Of course I did, only not so much as I do now."
Roran shook himself, as if waking from a dream. "I didn't. I knew that you and the elves would fight as hard as you could, but I didn't believe you could win." He met Aragorn's gaze. "Galbatorix has defeated so many riders, and you're but one, and not that old. It didn't seem possible."
"I know.
Now, though,"
a wolfish look came into Roran's eyes,
"now we have a chance."
"Aye," said Jormunda, "and just think, we no longer have to worry so much about Murtagh. He's no match for you and the dragons combined."
Aragorn drummed his heels against Saphira's leg and did not answer. He had other ideas on that front. Besides, he did not like to consider having to kill Murtagh. Then Orin spoke up.
"Umaroth says that you have devised a battle plan. Do you intend to share it with us, Shadeslayer?"
"I would like to hear it as well," said Islanzadi in a kinder tone.
"And I,"
said Oryk. Aragorn stared at them for a moment, then nodded. To Islanzadi he said, "Is your army ready to fight?"
"It is. Long have we waited for our vengeance. We need wait no longer."
"And ours?" Aragorn asked, directing his words toward Orin, Jormunda, and Oryk.
"Mine Merlin are eager for battle," proclaimed Oryk.
Jormunda glanced at King Orin.
"Our men are tired and hungry, but their will is unbroken."
"The Urgals too?"
"Them too."
"Then we attack."
"When?"
demanded Orin.
"At first light."
For a moment, no one spoke. Roran broke the silence.
"Easy to say, hard to do."
"How?"
Aragorn explained. When he finished, there was another silence. Roran squatted and began to draw in the dirt with the tip of a finger.
"It's risky, but bold," said Oryk.
"Very bold."
There are no safe paths any more, said Aragorn. If we can catch Galbatorix unprepared, even a bit, it might be enough to tip the scales.
Jormungandr rubbed his chin.
Why not kill Murtagh first? That's the part I don't understand. Why not finish him and Thorn while we have the chance?
Because, Aragorn replied, then Galbatorix would know of them.
And he motioned toward where the hidden Eldunari floated.
We would lose the advantage of surprise.
What of the child?
Orin asked harshly.
What makes you think that she will accommodate you? She hasn't before.
This time she will,
Aragorn promised, more confidently than he felt. The king grunted, unconvinced. Then Islanzadi said,
Aragorn, it is a great and terrible thing you propose. Are you willing to do this? I ask not because I doubt your dedication or your bravery, but because this is something to be undertaken only after much consideration. So I ask you, are you willing to do this, even knowing what the cost may be?
Aragorn did not rise, but he allowed a bit of steel to enter his voice.
I am. It must be done, and we are the ones to whom the task has fallen. Whatever the cost, we cannot turn away now.
As a sign of her agreement, Saphira opened her jaws a few inches and then snapped them shut, punctuating the end of his sentence. Islanzadi turned her face toward the sky.
And do you and those you speak for approve of this, Umaroth Elder?
We do,
replied the white dragon.
Then here we go, Roran murmured. A matter of duty. The ten of them, including Umaroth, continued to talk for another hour. Orin required more convincing, and there were numerous details to decide. Questions of timing and placement and signalling.
Aragorn was relieved when Arya said,
Unless either you or Saphira object, I will accompany you tomorrow. We would be glad to have you, he said.
Islanzadi stiffened.
What good would that accomplish? Your talents are needed elsewhere, Arya. Blodgarm and the other spellcasters I assigned to Saphira and Aragorn are more skilled at magic than you, and more experienced in battle as well. Remember they fought against the Forsworn, and unlike many, they lived to tell of it. Many of the elder members of our race would volunteer to take your place. It would be selfish to insist upon going when there are others better suited for the task who are willing and close at hand. I think no one is as suited for the task as Arya, Aragorn said in a calm voice. And there is no one other than Saphira I would rather have by my side.
Islanzadi kept her gaze upon Arya, and to Aragorn said,
You are still young, Shadeslayer, and you are allowing your emotions to cloud your judgment. No, mother, said Arya. It is you who are allowing your emotions to cloud your judgment.
She moved toward Islanzadi with long, graceful steps.
You are right. There are others who are stronger, wiser, and more experienced than I. But it was I who ferried Saphira's egg about Alagazia, I who helped save Aragorn from the Shade Durza, and I who, with Aragorn's help, killed the Shade Varrog in Feinster. Like Aragorn, I am now a Shadeslayer, and you well know that I swore myself in service to our people long ago. Who else among our kind can claim as much? Even if I wanted to, I would not turn away from this. I would sooner die. I am as prepared for this challenge as any of our elders, for it is to this I have devoted the whole of my life, as has Aragorn. And the whole of your life has been so short, said Islanzadi. She put her hand up to Arya's face. You have devoted yourself to fighting Galbatorix all these years since your father's death. But you know little of the joys life can provide, and in those years we have spent such a small amount of time together.
A handful of days scattered throughout a century. It is only since you brought Saphira and Aragorn to Ellesmira that we have begun to speak once more, as a mother and daughter ought. I would not lose you again so soon, Arya. It was not I who chose to remain apart, said Arya.
No, said Islandzadi, and she took her hand away. But it was you who chose to leave de Weldenvarden. Her expression softened.
I do not wish to argue, Arya. I understand that you see this as your duty. But please, for my sake, will you not allow another to take your place?
Arya lowered her gaze and was silent for a time. Then she said,
I cannot allow Aragorn and Saphira to go without me, any more than you can allow your army to march into battle without you at its head. I cannot... Would you have it said of me that I am a coward? Those of our family do not turn away from what must be done. Do not ask me to shame myself.
The shine in Islandzadi's eyes looked suspiciously like tears to Aragorn.
Yes, said the queen. But to fight Galbatorix... If you are so afraid, said Arya, but not unkindly, then come with me.
I cannot.
I must stay to command my troops, and I must go with Aragorn and Saphira. But I promise you, I shall not die.
Arya placed her hand on Islandzadi's face, even as her mother had done to her.
I shall not die.
Once more, Arya repeated the phrase, but this time in the ancient language. Arya's determination impressed Aragorn. To say what she had in the ancient language meant that she believed it without qualification. Islandzadi also appeared impressed, and proud too. She smiled and kissed Arya once on each cheek.
Then go, and go with my blessings, and take no more risks than you must. Nor you.
And the two of them embraced. As they separated, Islandzadi looked at Aragorn and Saphira and said,
Watch over her, I implore you, for she has not a dragon or the Eldunari to protect her.
We will, both Aragorn and Saphira replied in the ancient language. Once they had settled what needed to be settled, the war council broke and its various members began to disperse. From where he sat by Saphira, Aragorn watched the others mill about. Neither he nor she made an effort to move. Saphira was going to remain hidden behind the hill until the attack, while he intended to wait for dark before he ventured into the camp. Oryk was the second to depart after Rohan. Before he did, the Dwarf King came over to Aragorn and gave him a rough hug.
Ah, I wish I were going with the two of you, he said, his eyes solemn above his beard.
And I wish you were coming, said Aragorn.
Well, we'll see each other afterward, and toast our victory with barrels of mead, eh?
I look forward to it.
As do I, said Saphira.
Good,
said Oryk, and he nodded firmly.
That's settled, then. You better not let Galbatorix get the better of you, or I'll be honour-bound to march in after you.
We'll be careful, Aragorn said with a smile.
I should hope so, because I doubt I could do much more than tweak Galbatorix on the nose.
That I would like to see, said Saphira.
Oryk grunted.
May the gods watch over you, Aragorn. And you as well, Saphira.
And you, Oryk, Thrift's son.
Then Oryk slapped Aragorn on the shoulder and stomped off to where he had tied his pony to a bush. When Islandzadi and Blodgarm left, Arya stayed. She was deep in conversation with Jormunda, and so Aragorn thought little of it. When Jormunda rode off, however, and Arya still lingered nearby, he realized that she wanted to talk to them alone. Sure enough, once everyone else had gone, she looked at him and Saphira and said,
Did something else happen to you while you were gone? Something that you didn't want to speak of in front of Orin or Jormunda? Or my mother?
Why do you ask? She hesitated.
Because you both seem to have changed. Is it the Eldunari? Or does it have to do with your experience in the storm?
Aragorn smiled at her perception. He consulted with Saphira, and when she approved, he said,
We learned our true names.
Arya's eyes widened.
You did? And were you pleased with them?
In part, said Saphira.
We learned our true names, Aragorn repeated. We saw that the earth is round, and during the flight here, Umaroth and the other Eldunari shared many of their memories with us.
He allowed himself a wry smile.
I can't say we understand all of them, but they make things seem different.
I see, murmured Arya.
Do you think the change is for the better?
I do.
Change itself is neither good nor bad, but knowledge is always useful. Was it difficult to find your true names?
So he told her how they had accomplished it, and he also told her about the strange creatures they had encountered on Vroengard Island, which interested her greatly. As Aragorn spoke, an idea occurred to him, one that resonated within him too strongly to ignore. He explained it to Saphira, and once again she granted him her permission, although somewhat more reluctantly than before.
Must you?
She asked.
Yes.
Then do as you will, but only if she agrees.
When they had finished speaking of Vroengard, he looked Arya in the eyes and said,
Would you like to hear my true name? I would like to share it with you.
The offer seemed to shock her.
No, you shouldn't tell it to me or anyone else, especially not when we're so close to Galbatorix. He might steal it from my mind. Besides, you should only give your true name to one whom you trust above all others.
I trust you.
Aragorn, even when we elves exchange our true names, we do not do so until we have known each other for many, many years. The knowledge they provide is too personal, too intimate, to bandy about, and there is no greater risk than sharing it. When you teach someone your true name, you place everything you are in their hands.
I know, but I may never have the chance again.
This is the only thing I have to give, and I would give it to you. Aragorn, what you are proposing, it is the most precious thing one person can give another.
I know. A shiver ran through Arya, and then she seemed to withdraw within herself. After a time, she said,
No one has ever offered me such a gift before. I'm honored by your trust, Aragorn, and I understand how much this means to you. But no, I must decline. It would be wrong for you to do this, and wrong for me to accept, just because tomorrow we may be killed or enslaved. Danger is no reason to act foolishly, no matter how great our peril.
Aragorn inclined his head. Her reasons were good reasons, and he would respect her choice.
Very well, as you wish, he said. Thank you, Aragorn.
A moment passed. Then he said,
Have you ever told anyone your true name?
No.
Not even your mother?
Her mouth twisted.
No.
Do you know what it is?
Of course. Why would you think otherwise?
He half shrugged.
I didn't.
I just wasn't sure. Silence came between them. Then,
How did you learn your true name?
Arya was quiet for so long, he began to think that she would refuse to answer. Then she took a breath and said,
It was a number of years after I left Duweldenvarden, when I finally had become accustomed to my role among the Varden and the dwarves. Faelan and my other companions were away, and I had a great deal of time to myself. I spent most of it exploring Trondheim, wandering in the empty reaches of the city mountain, where others rarely tread.